verse 21 on the matter of covetousness. And I've called tonight the matter of the heart, because this is a commandment that gets right to the heart. This cuts right to the heart of things. And you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or your neighbor, and you shall not desire your neighbor's house, his field or his married servant or his female servant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. There it is. I kind of pointed out to you in previous sermons that from you shall not murder, which is verse 17, that commandment there, each of these commandments from that point onwards is linked by the word and. You shall not murder, and you shall not commit, and you shall not steal, and so on and so forth, going right the way through this commandment in verse 21. And you shall not covet, and you shall not desire, this word and. And I've made the point several times that the reason that and is there is because you won't find it in the book of Exodus. When you saw, if we were witnesses and we'd seen the two tablets on which the commandments were written, that and wasn't there. If you can look it up in Exodus chapter 20, and it just states it in list form. It says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. So it's just like a list. There's the word. But what's happening when we read it in Deuteronomy? Here is Moses preaching the word. He's preaching it. He's taking the commandments and he's applying it to the lives of the people. This is one long, continuous sentence. And you shall not do that, and you shall not. He's driving the point home. He's preaching. We're listening to Moses preaching. I've made this point several times. And we've looked at the differences between what we read here in Deuteronomy, Moses preaching the commandments, and compared them to what you see in Exodus 20, which is how God gave the commandments in that, you know, original form. And looked at some of the times the differences are quite helpful to us to get behind what Moses is particularly seeking to do in his preaching here. I'd be very surprised, be amazed if anybody here would spot the differences in the structure and the order in chapter 5, verse 21, compared to what you'd find in Exodus chapter 20 of this particular commandment. Because for us, most of these commandments are things that we know the headlines to. Most of us will say, thou shalt not kill, shalt not commit adultery. But whether we know the actual formula and detail and know it by heart, I'd be very, very surprised. But these commandments were so crucial to the life of these people, I believe they knew them intimately. And so the little differences between the way it was written and the way he preached them might, at least amongst some of them, have made something of an impression. But anyway, they certainly make an impression on me. So if I can point out to you, for example, in Deuteronomy, he begins by saying, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Whereas in Exodus, it says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, to start with. And if you then follow on, he then says house in Deuteronomy, whereas in Exodus, then it's wife. So there's a slight difference in order. Okay, it's not a big deal, but there's a difference. Then he goes on in Deuteronomy, says, you shall not covet your neighbor's fields. But in Exodus, there's no mention of fields at all. The point I'm making here is he's not reading it out. He's preaching it. He's preaching it. Then the next part of the order is the same, male, female servants, ox, donkeys, anything. And that's true in both cases. And there's another little difference as well. So there's one difference I've pointed out to you, and I hope I'll show something more from it in a moment. But there's another little difference as well, that in the writing of it in Exodus, he uses the word covet twice. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Whereas in Deuteronomy before you, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, and you shall not desire. Can you see there's a different word there? That's not a big deal. But he's not reading it. He's not reading it, and he's not slavishly being bound to it, but he's grappling with what is written, and he's preaching it. And I hope we'll see that's the importance of all of this. You see, because you could say he's showing a slightly blithe disregard for the word of God. Some people like to dot the I's and cross the T's, don't they? You know, what are you doing, Moses? Are you really handling the text with the respect that it deserves? You sort of seem to be paraphrasing the commandment in some sort of way and using it to your own ends, to make your own point to some extent. But come on, we're not going to stand here tonight and spend any time trying to think that Moses is not a faithful preacher of God's word. He is being utterly faithful to the spirit of what is written here, because you look at whichever way you put it, Exodus or Deuteronomy, the last word there, what's the last word? The last word is anything. Yes? That last word, that word is one of these all-encompassing words. In short, the list does not matter. The order is not specifically supposed to be put there to be an importance of an order of significance or anything. Do you know, anything can come between you and God. Right? That's the point, isn't it? It's anything. So putting it all in order, to be tripping over all the detail, is not the point. You've got to realize that the world around us and relationships and all the things that are in this world, if you are not wise to it, these things can become a snare. They can become a snare to your hearts. Things have a power, don't they? We can give things power. And those things will take some sort of grip on our hearts. That's the first point I really want to bring out this evening to you. The order is irrelevant, because the truth is anything can become a problem. Anything can become a problem. He's warning them. They're going into a new land with all sorts of new things. And the truth is they have to have their eyes open. They've got to be wise. They've got to be smart and realize that all sorts of things are going to be waiting there to get a hold of them and lead their lives and take them away from their faith in God. Okay, that's the real first point. So, I mentioned that he uses his word desire as well as the word covet. And he's used that word, he's brought it in. It wasn't there in the original text. But you know, this is what preachers do or should do, and we've got to do it when we're talking to people. You know, you've got to explain the Bible to people. You can't just tell people. You've also got to explain it to people, don't you? You've got to open up the word to people. This word desire helps us to understand what's at the base of covetousness. What is covetousness all about? This relationship that we can get into towards things or relationships. And desire is something that is much more accessible to us. If I said to the word covetousness, if I asked the kids here to give us a definition of covetous, and I ask you to have a definition of desire, I think you'd find it easier to do the second one, right? Yes? If I said the things we want, that's also be faithful, wouldn't it? The things we want, we understand our wants, right? You want something. Have you ever said, I want this? You recognize that? That's what this is all about. It's the things that you want. We want things, right? People want things. Is that true? Things just are attractive and they're interesting and you end up wanting them. And that's just a part of life. And it could be anything. People collect all sorts of strange things, don't they? Beads and marbles or whatever, collections of Doctor Who memorabilia. They've got a house full of this stuff. They just have these fascinations and desires. It could be absolutely anything. And there's nothing wrong with wanting things or desiring things. But here's the problem, and this is what he's talking about. What if those things belong to somebody else? What if God has given those things to somebody else? You know, not to pick on the kids here, but we've seen it. Sometimes the wonderful thing about children is that they're so transparent. We're so clever, aren't we? We're obviously much more guarded a lot of the time. But a little child sometimes in a room, they're quite happy, they're having a lovely time. Another child walks in there and they have this something. It could be really random, really, really out there. See, but suddenly they see it and you can just see they want it, right? And it's solely, and they play these games, don't they? You know, I'll give you this if I can have that. You can see them doing everything. And when they can't get it, they get frustrated and angry, and you get tantrums. I want, I want, I want. And we're not different. We're the same as children. We're just grown up and more sophisticated, aren't we? And our desires may be more complicated, but in a sense, we're all the same. We're all the same. We have these desires. I want to be that person's friend. I want to have that relationship with that person. I want to be in with this crowd. I want to have this experience. I want to go there. I've seen that this person's putting this photograph on Facebook of these amazing places. Why don't I ever get to go to places like that? Or maybe it's the possessions that people have, the car on their drive. It can reach to absolutely anything. That's the point, anything. And the problem is that for whatever reason, at that particular time, the Lord has not given you those things. They've given them to somebody else. What are you going to do about it? How are you going to respond to it? But truly what Paul, the Apostle Paul, later in Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, he says, if you start desiring and pursuing after those things, if you start going after things like that, and they're not the things that the Lord has given you, they've been given to somebody else, you are straying into, what does Paul say? You're becoming idolaters, right? It's becoming idolatry. Chapter 3, verse 5 of the book of Colossians. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desires, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Suddenly, this thing, whatever it might be, and that's the point, whatever it might be, comes between you and God. That's the thing you must have. That's the thing you must do. I will come to God when I have this thing. I will come if I could only worship you in this circumstance, under these conditions. The music has to be like this, or whatever it might be. It could be anything, couldn't it? And this thing becomes larger, more important, more compelling, more demanding upon our hearts than God himself. We want, I want, I want, I want. Maybe you've had the conversation with people, you know, you're talking to them about the faith and you're calling people to Jesus. First I must do this. When this is in place. And those things, whatever it might be, have become elevated. They've become more important than just knowing God and knowing peace with God. That happens, doesn't it? And we can be like that too. We become obsessed, addicted to things, and just more and more things. So I've said, look, really, anything can become a problem. And the reason it becomes a problem, the reason it's a problem, because anything can become your God. Yeah? You can make a God out of anything. So, what's the opposite to this? We're not even talking about it. It's very unsettled, isn't it? It's a very unhappy place. To be in that, you know, one of the translations of this word is lust, to be lusting after something. It's not a peaceful place to be, right? It's not a good place to be when you're hankering, when you're wanting, consumed by a desire. It's not a happy place to be, right? Agreed? The opposite of that, I think, is contentment. Contentment. I mean, just to mention the word does you good, doesn't it? Contentment. Yes? Given the choice between this constant demand for more and contentment, give me contentment, give me contentment. And this is an expression, it's an expression of faith, isn't it? It's like, you know, God, you're enough. I know you. You know me. I'm happy. I know God. God knows me. And what he's provided for me, it's good. I'm not looking around. I'm looking at what I've got. And I'm saying, Lord, thank you. Here it is. Here it is. I'm looking at my relationships. I'm looking at the people around me. I'm looking at the situation, the reality of the situation of my life. I don't know. Other people have got different lives, and they're living different kinds of lives. This is the life you've given me. Thank you. Thank you, Lord. Here I am. Here I am. That is a very different proposition to this kind of constant striving to be something else, to be someone else, to have something else, and particularly, specifically, just because these things don't belong to you, because they're somebody else's, because they're out of your reach. To just be happy with your relationships and your possessions and your situation, to be happy with life, to be thankful, just to be a thankful person. That's the antidote, isn't it, to this covetousness, just to be a thankful, contented soul. It's a bit like something we said this morning, but you could say that, well, that's quite easy to say, isn't it, to be contented when you've got a pretty good life, really. And, you know, all is well in the world and the sun is shining and got a new car on the drive and you've got a good job and kids are doing well or whatever it might be. You know, your life is pretty good. That's contentment is about having your ducks in a row and you've got it all sorted out and you've got your pension plan and, you know, that's contentment. You know, that's the world's view of contentment, isn't it? You've got it organized. You've got it sorted. You're in control. It's a well-managed situation. And now I'm content. I will be content when and all this sort of thing. I think one of the greatest expressions of contentment, remarkable expressions of contentment, is found in the book of Lamentations. And for those of you who know the book, will know that it was written by Jeremiah after the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. And literally, the whole city has been completely destroyed. And he says, and people sing it. New every morning, thy mercies I see. Yeah, it's become a favorite hymn. He was writing, you know, what's been going on in Aleppo recently. You know, picture that. And he's waking up and saying, okay, we haven't been consumed. The Lord's mercies do endure forever. Here I am. I'm going to praise you. I'm going to praise you. Well, you know, it says in Thessalonians, being thankful in every circumstance, in every situation, giving thanks. It's not based on your circumstances. It's him, isn't it? It's you look up and you say, you and I have you, Lord. I have you. And you're the source of my joy. You're the source of my contentment. You're the source of my peace. And the circumstances of my life, the providences in my life at this particular life, whether good or bad, I'm going to praise you. I'm going to praise you. I'm going to express contentment out of my relationship with you. It's not about achieving your life goals. If you think, how many of us have made them say, I've done it. You think, if I can get to this place, if I've got this situation, if I've attained to that point, then I'll be happy, then I'll be content. It's never like that when you get there, right? It's like a shifting target. It's always moving. But God is with us. God is with us. So, now, I'm not teaching or preaching fatalism. You know, fatalism is this idea, well, this is the situation God's given, this is where I'm supposed to be, and to try and even change this situation or move away from this situation, that would be kind of to grieve God, because, you know, this is what he's given for me, so to try and change it would be wrong. This whole idea of karma, I must have done something in my past life, and now I'm reaping it, and so I'm going to be content with the kind of situation that I have now. That's not what we're talking about. Thankfulness is this active, relational kind of byproduct of our relationship with God and our knowledge that we can look to him for our betterment and the change of our circumstances and situation. We can pray. We can use the means of grace that he has given us. You know, in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6, we read, godliness with contentment is great gain. And that sounds good, doesn't it? Godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world. We cannot take anything out of the world. Good to just to remember that sometimes, isn't it? To detach ourselves from the things and hold on to God. He says, if we've got food and clothing with these, we're going to be content. I don't think it's suggesting that every Christian should just have a pair of trousers and a jumper and that's it, and the food they have in their stomach. That's not what's being. But if that is the situation, you can still be content. You can still be content. And then he goes on to talk about how those who desire to be rich, and this is the desire I think Moses is talking about in this commandment, desire to be rich, who are coveting riches, fall into temptations, they fall into snares, into many senseless and harmful desires, 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6, senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. And you can stop and think about what that means. For the love of money, this is one of the most often misquoted verses in the Bible. For the love of money, it's not money, it's the love of money, is not the root of all evil, it is a root of all evil. Just hankering after obtaining more and more and more and more is a kind of evil, it's a misery. People just go after these things, don't they? And they expect, you've probably heard about the guy fishing. Do you know the story about the guy fishing? He's just, you know, he's got his little boat out there fishing on a boat, and the guy from the city comes out or whatever and says, you know, why you can just go out fishing? It's so crazy. You just kind of spend all day out there fishing in the boat and stuff. Why couldn't you just, like, you know, if you could, you know, hire somebody, you get them out on the boat, you know, if you doubled your catch and stuff like that, and, you know, you could diversify, you could afford to buy a couple of nets and all this sort of thing. I'll you get the general idea. If you build yourself a fishing enterprise and you end up being the manager and the corporation of this great fishing fleet and all the rest of it and all the rest. And then the guy says, well, okay, that sounds all great, but why? Why would I want to do that? Well, so in the end, so you could, you know, get a boat and spend the day going out fishing. We do need to think about why we're doing what we're doing, don't we? We need to look at the motives. Is this about me? Is this about how I want to be seen, who I want people to think I am, all those sort of things? Or is there a good purpose for what I'm doing? The love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. And it's through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith. And that's the point, that when you start coveting things, when you start wanting what other people have gotten, just that begins to drive your life. And folks, we are being bombarded, aren't we, all the time with images to get us more and more avaricious and greedy and aspirational all the time. Until I'm here, until I'm there, then you'll be. You already are. Through this craving, some have wandered away. And once these things, and I've seen people, I can tell you, especially talented, clever, gifted people, able people, I've seen people gradually as the calls and the demands of the pursuit of these things, and they don't show up so often, they don't communicate so often, and they start to just wander away. And you know how you go, and I know people that have just after weeks you talk, you know, how are you doing, or you know, they're just nowhere with the Lord. They're just nowhere with the Lord because they've given themselves to these things. It's come between them and God. It happens. It comes between them and God. You know, there's nothing wrong with working towards your enrichment and the betterment of your friends and your family and doing good in the world. But don't hanker after it. That's the point. Keep that contentment in place. Don't get to coveting. Don't get to envy. Don't let greed get a grip on your life. You see, this commandment is getting right to the heart. Cutting right to the heart. Why are you doing this? What's your motivation? What's this all about? What are you trying to achieve, really? So that's my third point. Because here's the problem. Things make poor gods. You can make a god out of anything, but they're rubbish. They're very bad gods. They won't serve you, and they certainly can't save you. They won't save you. How many people have thought, you know, that my riches will save me? You know, in the times of trouble, they think, I'll be able to buy my way out of it. It doesn't work out like that. Only God can save. You can't pay your way to heaven. What are you going to pay God on the door? What are you going to offer him? What does he want that you've got? In the end, you have to kiss it all goodbye. You have to kiss it all goodbye. You have to let it all go. But if you've got Christ, The words here for covet and desire, the word covet is ava. And if I stand like this, because ava is a very kind of graphic word, it's sort of somebody who's bending over, you know, like that when a car drives past and you kind of go like that, you know, when it's kind of turning your head. And covet is the changing of your spiritual direction. Something that has so grabbed hold of you is bending you out of shape. You're no longer upright. It's inappropriate. It's unseemly. It's wrong. It's ungodly. It's ungodly. It doesn't recognize the truth of who God is and what he's given you. You're blessed people. You're a blessed people. It's actually quite an onomatopoeic word. In the sense it sounds a bit like what it describes as well, because it's also a word that used to describe the howl of a wolf. Like this, you know. And if you've ever been out somewhere where there are wolves, have you ever been anywhere, have you ever heard wolves? It's a remarkable sound, and it's just so haunting, but they sound so unhappy. They sound so like they're consumed by longing and desire and wanting and loneliness and everything. They've just been eaten up by this awful howl sound. It seems like they're consumed by lust. That's what it sounds like. I'm not sure they are because I don't know them that well. But the other word, chamad, which is translated desire, that Moses uses for desire, that's a much more neutral word. It's It's the things we delight in. Yeah, these are good emotions. It's good to delight in things, isn't it? There are good things that God has given us. You know, you can look around you. There are good things that you can delight in. You can truly delight in. And the problem of covetousness, it takes all that and it distorts it and it bends it out of shape. And you end up loving, instead of what is good, you end up loving something that's all wrong. It's all wrong. And our feelings have got the better of us. Can you see that this commandment takes us right down to the very nature of temptation? Where temptation? What causes sin in the world? All these misguided desires. Are there people, do you see misguided people? Can you see people pursuing after things that will not achieve for them and not obtain for them happiness, the things that they want? It's kind of crazy, isn't it? That all the problems in the world, I think this commandment is telling us that all the problems in the world originate with these feelings of strange things. You can't see them. They all pop up in our heart, don't they? These desires, these wants, these passions and stuff in our hearts. And just seizing hold of the wrong ones and doing the wrong things with them is what causes all the problems we see in the world. These impulses, these feelings. Because you know what happens. You can just get hold of one of these feelings and it produces all sorts of thoughts and suggests ideas to you. And if you're not careful, you can start to put these things into action and that can become your lifestyle. That can become the way you live your life. It can go on for weeks or months or years. Some people's cases, it takes the whole of their life. It consumes the whole of their life. I'm somebody who's been with people at the end of their lives. I've been in hospitals quite several times. There are people who are literally at the ends of their lives. And like, in one sense, they've entered into the reckoning. And how they've spent their lives, what have they done with the time that they've given? Their strength is ebbing away. There is no more time. Time is gone. Opportunity is finished. And there are people who just, they're just faced with just the emptiness. And I've been with other people who are so thankful. And it's all to do with your heart. Jesus, this is Jesus, Matthew chapter 15, verse 8. What comes out of the mouth proceeds from your heart. It all comes out of our hearts. That's what defiles a person, because that's where the evil thoughts and the murder, all these things, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false, it's all a desire, isn't it, for things that are not yours. You're trying to witness, slander, false witness, slander. All the commandments, Jesus is saying, they all proceed from this one commandment. If you start coveting, you'll break all the rest. It all starts in here. That's what defiles a person. You know, eating with unwashed hands, said Jesus, is not going to defile anybody. But looking over at your neighbor's life and just allowing yourself to get your eye off God and what he's given you and start to get consumed, that can possibly destroy you and them. You've got to be careful. So this fourth point really is, you've got to, if you want to keep these commandments, you've got to realize it's the heart. It's like a factory of idols, and we've got to keep a watch on our hearts. We've got to stay on top. Very briefly and finally, where does all this leave us? I think this commandment tells us where the problem is. Where's our big problem? It's in here, isn't it? You don't have to look any further. Sometimes we're looking around for the answers to our problems. It's here. It's here. And think about it. This commandment takes us right to the heart. But then all the other commandments are also about the heart too. If you're going to love God, what do you do? What do you love God with? Your heart. What do you love yourself with? It comes from your heart. If you love other people, I mean, if you don't want to avoid murdering and committing adultery, you have to respect and regard and care for these people. That's all from your heart, isn't it? It's all about our heart. And Moses is about to send all these people who he's preaching to, about to invade and go and conquer the Holy Land. They've got all sorts of battles ahead. I'm sure you've got plenty of challenges and things ahead of you too. But if you can win this battle, the rest will follow. This is the battle we have to win first. In one sense, if you can win there, you can win anywhere. But if they go into the promised land and their hearts start to go in after this and that and everything else, they'll just lose direction. The whole thing will slow down. They won't succeed. when we look at what happens to Israel when they go into the land, the shortcomings, where do those shortcomings come from? They came from their heart, the attitudes of their hearts, wanting things other than what God had given them. So, I don't know, wouldn't it be nice if all our problems was our foot? If the big problem in my life was my foot, I mean, you could, I suppose, have an operation, have it surgically removed, couldn't you? Or if it was my eye, I suppose I could manage with one. Or if it was my hand, I could cut it off. But if it's my heart, what am I going to do? Are you going to cut it out? How am I going to... This is where the problem is. Who can deal with my problem? Who can deal with this problem? And this takes us back up to the first commandment. It takes us back to God, because the only one who can change your heart is Him. We have to go back to Him. Jesus said, you know, about putting your trust in Him, out of the person who believes in God, out of their heart will proceed rivers of living water. Rivers of living water. So let me ask you, your stream, the stream that flows out of your heart, would you describe it as a river of living water? There's this constant source of pure desires and pure wants and pure aspirations and pure ambitions. Is that your experience? If I'm being honest, you know, I think sometimes the waters are mixed. Stuff comes out and I think, well, that was a bit salty, or that was a bit polluted. What do you do? What do you do when you get to that point where you suddenly realize that your heart is getting polluted, or your heart has gone wrong, and you're desiring things that are not of Him? What do you do about that? Go back to God, don't you? You go back to the source, you go back to Him. You go back in repentance, you go and recognize what's happened in your heart, and you pray, fill me afresh. Renew my heart. I want rivers of living water. I want to speak and pursue after vanity. I want to pursue after godliness. Help me. Help me, Lord. I don't know if you've ever wondered how this commandment could ever have been prosecuted. You know, these Ten Commandments all carry the death penalty. The maximum was the death penalty in all these commandments. How would you prosecute somebody for covetousness? How would you get them into the dock? What would you do? You see, I think the truth is that a lot of this stuff is going on in the heart. But once you start to act on these things and follow these thoughts and feelings up, they begin to manifest into plans, don't they? You start to plan. You start to hatch a plan. You start to say something. You start to incite something. And even to this day, those things are crimes in our own country, aren't they? There are, you know, hate speech or whatever. These things, you know, not everything that everything that goes to court is some theft or something like that. You can say things, you can exhibit things, and it can get you into a lot of trouble. People are planning something, you can get into a lot of trouble for that. And I think we've got to keep a watch on ourselves and each other. So stuff starts to come out and you realize somebody's going away from the Lord. Things have got a hold of them, and we need to be there to encourage them when we start to see the signs, and when we start to feel the signs, to call us back. No, nobody in this room is going to live a perfect life. And, you know, these things will happen. And we need each other. We need the discipline of the Holy Spirit, don't we? We need His help. Because we know that the wages of sin is death. If we let these things get a hold of us, it can just destroy our lives. And can destroy other people's lives too. And the only person who's going to get saved, rescued from this, is the one who has a God they can turn to, who can help them. As have you ever known the Lord help you? Have you ever brought something to the Lord like this? Have you ever known that your heart was wrong about a thing and you've come to the Lord about it? Has He ever helped you? We're just talking empty words here? Or can God save your soul? Can He bring you back to Himself? He can, can't He? And He can forgive you for the things we've done. We have Jesus Christ and His shed blood and His broken body. We have an absolute guarantee of forgiveness, so we can start again and get at rest and get back with God. Because I believe that these laws are written here, not that we should gain our righteousness from doing all these things. Christ is our righteousness. He covers us. But they remain a guide to godly living, don't they? And they help. It's like your rod and your staff, they comfort me. They're like the rod and the staff of God. They comfort us and they help us to go in the right direction, showing us the way as we put our trust in him. We're going to take communion tonight, and these emblems are an expression, aren't they, of Christ's broken body. And if you're like me, as I know you are, you've got a heart that is wicked and has its own agenda and will have you go this way and that. You need cleansing. You need forgiveness. You need grace. You need the love of God. You need the mercy seat to turn to for forgiveness. You need Christ. I need Christ. And this table reminds us that Christ is here. Christ is with us. He has given his body. He's given his blood. We just have to feed on him by faith, to be refreshed, to be renewed. So let's just take a moment quietly just to reflect on our lives.